Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
It's unbelievable how much leverage the private equity community is using. And it sounds sexy, but that's where I'm concerned we're going to see a lot of the next big troubles come from in the foundations of the economy.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Finance University. I'm your host, Chris Martinson of Peak Financial Investing, and I've got again with me Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hey, Paul, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Chris. Happy Fed Day to you.
Fed Day. Happy Fed Day. We got to talk about that. No action. Nothing changed. Holding steady, which, of course, is Trump was advocating for cuts. But I want to talk about, Paul, I think QE has restarted. That's quantitative easing. I have a question mark. I'm not positive, but got some data. I have to talk about peak oil, and because that's no longer a thing that I just talk about. That's in Bloomberg now. And then Bessent said a couple of interesting things. One of them was no CBDCs. There's supposed to be another C in there. That's not no CBDs. CBDCs. So that's what's on my plate for today. And, you know, some interesting stuff there. And what do you want to talk about today?
Oh, I'm good with that. I'll follow your lead today. I've just been catching up on watching everything that's taken place under the surface of the market. I've got a little bit of data. We don't know how this is going to pan out. We don't know how the Fed's going to step in, you know, behind the scenes quantitative easing now. We thought that they were doing tightening. And, you know, is it possible that we could be in a similar unfolding of the 2008 kind of pre-crisis or later in the year market action?
Yep. All right. Well, then we could start with this. So the Coastal Journal, who I follow over on X, says the Fed purchased over $20 billion, worth of three-year notes. Those are bonds today, making the largest daily purchases since the era of quantitative easing in 2021. Paul, they bought $20.4 billion of three-year notes. I'm old enough to remember when $20 billion was a big number. No, that's a big number. That's actually a big number. That's the Fed in a spot by the SOMA. It says S-O-M-A over there, the System Open Market Account. The Fed, when they do quantitative easing, which is a fancy word of saying clickety-click on a keyboard and make money come out of thin air and use it to buy things, this is the mechanism. The SOMA goes out, says, oh, we'll take $20.4 billion of three-year paper that's being auctioned, and they type on their keyboards and... wouldn't you know it? $20.4 billion of credit goes flying out the door. And that's money. So that's how it works. This is it in action. This is what it looks like. So credit to the Coastal Journal for keeping a close eye on a wonky part of the Treasury website where they talk about their auction results. Yeah. Look at that. What do you think they're up to?
That's a lot of liquidity to bring into the system. We've seen financial conditions tightening. We've also seen yields hesitant to work their way down. They've come off their highs a little bit here recently, but it's interesting to me because I did not know that data until you just presented that. But I did see the headlines with basically the government bragging about how strong the auction was here recently for the Treasury market. So that tells me where a lot of the demand came from out of the blue, quite frankly.
Yep. Well, so that's the System Open Market Account, but maybe that was just May 5th, you know, Cinco de Mayo, you know. They were just partying with everybody else, except on the 6th, the System Open Market Account bought another $14.8 billion, this time of 10-year bonds. So, Paul, one thing that you and I have talked about is that even though it looks like maybe the economy is weakening a little, which is usually constructive for more bond buying, so bond yields should go down. Indeed, in that big little mini panic, that three-day panic around Trump and tariffs, indeed, bonds got bought. 10-year yields went down. And they've since been going back up again. So I'm not surprised to see the Fed stepping in and being a buyer of the 10-year bonds. I'm just surprised that they didn't mention this to anybody. Thought they could just sort of sneak that out there.
Me too. And most market participants don't care, except for the major banks. And one of the things that we've seen, or I've had questions on, is how quickly do these banks know that this is taking place? Because quite frankly, for a lot of these traders and speculators, liquidity is all that matters. They're not paying attention to fundamentals anymore. So if the Fed's kind of letting the market know that that's taking place, and the individuals like you and the big institutions that are paying attention know this, and that provides a tailwind to the markets, in spite of the fact that they come out and say that they're staying steady.
Well, the markets have been under a bit of a rescue since three Sundays ago now, and I could detect it, and we talked about it at the time, but I can detect these things because magically, in the overnight markets, when nothing's happening but futures are open, I watch this telltale pattern where all the stock futures start climbing at once, and it's across the globe, right? You and I talk about this a lot. I can't tell the difference if you stripped off the axes off of these things and the legends. I wouldn't be able to tell you who's who because they trade in lockstep, minute for minute, tick by tick, 5-minute bars, almost identical. German market, European markets, Japanese, U.S., big tech, small tech, you know, industrials, doesn't matter, all the same. So I'm just painting the case here, Paul, that these are now one market, one integrated market. And I was wondering if the Fed, $20 billion on the 5th, $14 billion on the 6th. So that's $35 billion once you do the roundings. $35 billion in 2 days is a big number.
Yes, it is.
Now, why would the Fed step in with $35 billion over 2 days? And I think Holger Schapitz here, notice on May 6th, so this would have been reporting in from the 5th. Because German, anyway, they had a failed bond auction. Paul, I haven't seen an official sovereign failed bond auction in many a year.
No.
So the 5-year bond auction technically failed today, he writes, for an offer of 4.5 billion. They were just 4.5 billion euros of bonds. The German government's trying to auction out 5 years, 5-year paper. They only got bids for 4.264 billion. So in the end, they readjusted their offering to 3.48 billion and claimed victory and said, oh, we ended up selling. The bid to cover was 1.2. A bid to cover of one means you got one bid for every euro on offer. They claimed they had a ratio of 1.23, but in fact, it was a failed bond auction. They had to shave a billion off in order to get to that. So this is the kind of stuff that scares central bankers.
Understandably so. And to put that $20 billion into perspective, what was it several months ago? They were quantitative tightening, if I remember correctly. And you can remember these things really good. So it was $25 billion a month that they were tightening, that they were putting back into the system. And then they cut it down to $5 billion. So that was how much they had cut out of the system. So that basically, you know, negates what, if they're buying $20 billion, that was the number, right? $20.8 billion combined.
No, 35 combined.
35 combined, then, you know, that wipes out the $5 billion that they're putting on the market, and that's back to quantitative easing. That's a lot of liquidity into the system, and that's what this market seems to care more about than anything else at this moment in time.
Well, we talked about this for a while. So the mechanism was this. They said, oh, we're quantitative tightening, but, Paul, they could only do that because it was this other wonky thing where the banks had what were called excess reserves, and they were pushing them into something called the repo market. And because those repo funds were there, those were being used to buy the tranches of federal government paper coming out. And we were noting that was going from about 2.4 trillion. It was wobbling down and it was slated to hit zero sometime towards the end of March. I think that's what happened. March happens. They said, oh, we're going to dial back QT from 25 to 5. That's April. And now it's May, and we're already back to buying. That makes perfect sense. They just haven't announced it yet. So I think the Fed's already back to emergency procedures here.
And if you're letting the big banks know that you're going to be doing this, it makes sense that since Liberation Day, you have this market fit, and then the market's right back to even because that basically gave your big banks and institutions and traders the information of, hey, the Fed's got our back, even though they're not going to tell the retail investor that.
Well, remember we had that, it was really awkward. I remember the face you made when I said, oh, the day the market had that big turnaround rally, Scott Bessent had a private meeting with JP Morgan. Public wasn't invited. What do you think they talked about?
I remember the look on my face. I didn't remember it at the time, but I had a friend and a client that sent me a picture and put WTF and said, this is my new meme from this point forward.
You had
seriously.
So no, I mean, But that's a big deal. A failed auction. So that just says things are getting tight. And of course, what do you do when things are tight? You reliquify. So the Fed's going to have to come up, Paul, with some crazy reason for why they're reprinting. $35 billion is a lot of money.
That's a tremendous amount of money. That is a tremendous amount of money.
2 days. And boom, straight into the market.
And it's interesting to me that they targeted the 10-year in addition to that. So, you know, that's very important to Trump. That's very important to Secretary Bessent, from what I can tell. And the 10-year is the one gauge that gives the market information that things are not working as they seem.
Now, they're up against a heck of a tailwind or a headwind, depending on how you look at it, because of this. I didn't know this till Charlie Bilello sent it out. And did you realize the bond market's in a drawdown for 57 months? This is by far the longest drawdown in history.
I knew it had been down for a while, but I did not realize that it was the longest drawdown in history.
Well, so I had to go dig this up. I don't have the aggregate bond index. I didn't have access to that, but I did find a longer-term chart of the 30-year bond, sort of as a proxy for the aggregate bond index. But, I mean, you can see there from 1993 all the way on the left of that chart, all the way up, it's just like been getting up and up. It's just going up and up and up. Obviously, some wiggles, and there were some bad months and years in there. But since here, this has just been a drawdown.
Uh-huh.
That's a pretty long time. And, of course, it broke its 40-year trend line, which I think is relevant and important.
No, that's very relevant, very important from a long-term standpoint. But they call them technicals, but they're support and resistance levels. And to breach a trend line that's been in that place for that long, and especially the damage that's taken place on the other side and the damage that's still sitting on the bank balance sheets with those 30-year treasuries that are upside down like that, that's going to change behavior.
That's right. Anybody like the big banks, the big systems, anybody who thought it was an appropriate thing to buy a 30-year bond back here in 2020, say, at 180, I won't even tag them with buying whoever that poor sucker was at 190. But if you're at $180 there and now you're down to 114, from a bond standpoint, I know that looks, Paul, like oh, I mean, that's pretty bad already, right? 60 points off of 180, that's about a 30% drawdown. But it's much worse than that because of the duration of these bonds.
Yes, and the lost income in the interim period. I mean, not only that, you're losing the shorter-term income in a higher inflationary environment. And just to remind the listeners out there, that initial move is what took Silicon Valley Bank down because they were too far out on their duration and picking up pennies in front of a steamroller. And when interest rates went up, those bond values went down. That was what caused them to be in a capital situation and for them to go down.
All right. Before we go to the next part, Paul, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. The markets are unraveling and the stakes could not be higher. If you're relying on passive strategies or so-called diversification, or perhaps using an advisor who was, I don't know, maybe in elementary school during the great financial crisis, you could be on a collision course with staggering portfolio losses. Peak Financial Investing is your lifeline. We handpick wealth managers who will actively manage your portfolio with proven market-savvy strategies, not the tired modern portfolio theory that could crumble under pressure. The unprepared will not just lose this time, but lose big. The future that I see consists of both winners and losers, but many more losers this time than last time. Go to peakfinancialinvesting.com today and schedule your free consultation. This is your chance to protect your wealth. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. And I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, urging you, please, don't wait another day. All right, welcome back, everybody. So, Paul, the other part that's connected to this idea that you're having, you know, okay, bonds sell off, sometimes they do, but this is a break in a 40-year trend line. This is a very big moment right here. And what if they go, what if bonds fall for the next 40 years in price or go up in yield for 40 years? That would be what the Fed is fighting. And I know the Fed keeps its eye on a lot of things. But this chart by Tavi Costa caught me because, you know, it's only a question of time before your credit spreads start blowing out. Normally, you see leveraged loans and junk bonds trade tick for tick. Every so often, there's a little tiny departure. This is a giant air gap right here as far as this series goes. So they should be pretty tight. Leveraged loans and junk bonds, pretty close, kind of siblings in the same family. At any rate, leveraged loans are selling off. Junk bonds have not given up the ghost yet, but as soon as they do, we're going to start seeing credit spreads widening out, and then we're into that credit event. What do you make of this? Because that's unusual.
That is unusual, and I was just thinking about that. I have not seen that chart, and Tavi's put out some really good information lately. Like, you know, it's just kind of hit some of these extremes where he's putting it out there. I don't know if this is the correct answer or not, but I was at a funeral recently talking to a friend of mine that I've not talked to in a while, and he deals in big apartment complexes and sells to a lot of private equity institutions and pensions. And we got us having the conversation. I'm wondering if a lot of that, you know, private equity has been behind the scenes, and they're highly levered, highly levered. That's one of the things that concerns me about private equity. They have the ability to stay under the radar a little bit longer versus your mark to market. So I'm wondering if the reason why that hasn't cracked yet to follow those junk bonds has to do with the fact that that private equity is behind the scenes a little bit. But when they start having troubles, I would expect that to come together. And because they're levered to the hilt so heavily, it's unbelievable how much leverage the private equity community is using. And it sounds sexy, but that's where I'm concerned we're going to see a lot of the next big troubles come from in the foundations of the economy.
Well, and one of those is I have this conversation about twice a week now with people I talk to, say, I don't know what happened, but my insurance bills just went up by 30, 35, 40, 50%, like some obscene amount. Do you think there a chance, Paul, that they're going up that much, not because houses are burning down that much more often, but because they made some of these bad bets on some of these levered junk, or they have a bad portfolio of commercial mortgage-backed securities? I mean, are they just like nursing losses in one area because they were boneheads, and now they're making the rest of us pay higher premiums?
Well, that's my belief, and I don't have the data because they protect that data relatively closely, but I think it was about a year ago when we were reading all these reports about $300 million properties that sold in 2017 selling for $8 million. And how come that wasn't showing up into the banking system? And we had talked about the fact that the big insurance companies are the ones that own a lot of this commercial real estate. And I've been hearing around the edges and asking some of the agents, like, what is really going on? You know, are we having to increase our premiums to help offset the fact that they've made poor investments out there? And it's my belief that that's what the evidence points to, is that has a lot to do with the higher rates that we're all paying. And every consistent conversation I'm having, not just locally, but across this country. I understand Georgia is a very litigious state, so I get a little bit more in Georgia, but it doesn't matter from Maine to Alaska to Hawaii, all over the country. You can understand a little bit more in California and Florida with the natural disasters that they've had here recently, but everybody is consistently paying substantially higher rates on their insurance, and the only thing I can trace it back to is the fact that they had bad investments and they're having to make up for it at our expense. Another customer bailout or a taxpayer bailout, essentially. And I really wish that if that is the case, that there was somebody in our government that was actually saying, no, you can't do that. If you've made poor investments, then you're going to have to fail. And the other companies that made better investments are going to step up to the plate and take over your customer base. But that doesn't seem to be what's taking place at all right now.
No, we need consequences for this. So I would be okay if we said, listen, if it ever turns out you decided to try and juice your returns a little bit and it didn't work out, your C-suite has to give up clawbacks and no payment going forward, right? And then, you know, whatever else, right? Like no money back to shareholders. There's no dividends this year, right?
Correct.
Like I would want to make sure that everybody who's involved with that company, they take the losses first before they pass them on to consumers, because, you know, we all need to get paid and our shareholders deserve a dividend. It's like, no, next time, run your portfolio in a more careful manner.
Correct.
You might have slightly less exciting returns, you know? Your return on equity might be a little bit less than you want it to be, but that's called, you know, or take the risk. Take the risk, right? And then have to endure, like, really painful shareholder meetings, being yelled at by your board and not getting paid that year. That's fine.
That's right, and getting terminated. But the single mom that's struggling to get by with the government policies with high inflation shouldn't have to be carrying more of a burden because somebody that's making tens of millions of dollars made poor investments because they got a little greedy. Those investors yep. that are responsible for making sure that they're doing, you know, doing what's right as the CEO of that company and that board should fire that person, replace them, admit it, and move on.
Agreed. All right. With that cold, that side exploration. So the creaking, popping sounds, Paul, something's happening in bonds. I don't know what it is yet. And the fact that the Fed just had to throw $35 billion in a couple days in. Okay, we're going to keep our eye on that. But what's interesting, too, then, to me, is this, that this just came out today. The U.S. Treasury Secretary Bessent said, a central bank digital currency is a sign of weakness. I would not be in favor of the Fed, which he's a Treasury Secretary, not a Federal Reserve person. He says, I would not be in favor of the Fed issuing digital currency. So Trump said no CBDCs, Bessent saying no CBDCs. Clearly somebody in the background is saying yes CBDCs because they're busy saying no CBDCs. What are you making of this?
No, I like the fact that we're getting a little bit more communication out, because the prior administration, and this is the way I break it down, you have the prior administration, which were globalists. The globalists desire the CBDC because they want more control over the populace. They want more control over the people. Whereas you've got Trump and Secretary Bessent right now are saying, that's great information to me. No central bank digital currencies. That's a sign of weakness. We're going to stand on our own. And hopefully they're going to make the decisions to back our currency and give it a reason to be strong again.
I interpret this, too, through the larger lens of what we've been talking about, which is that there's this global realignment. Look, all fiat currencies have a lifespan, like a mayfly, right? You know, and they'll last 40, 50 years, but they just get away from you because of compounding. And so that's we're right in the window for having trouble with our current reserve currency, which we call the dollar. And as you and I have discussed it at length, there's a big mismatch between dollars are just claims on things. I know we call it wealth. It's not. If I have a lot of dollars, people say I'm wealthy. I'm not. What I have is I have a lot of claims on things that I might want to buy with that wealth, like a yacht or a property or a ranch or a skid steer, right? Whatever. I need to be able to spend that money on something, right? So we know that we have all this money and all this debt, and it's all piled up, and it's got a real math problem baked into it. And that's the thing that Scott Bessent is trying to sort of wrestle with, is how do we usher the country through this period of needing to fix all those imbalances without crashing the whole thing, without just up and wrecking it. Now, I don't know if they'll be successful, but I applaud them for recognizing it, communicating that, and trying to do something about it. Now, obviously, we should have started doing something about this in 1971, but here we are. To that end, you know, I found this a little bit fascinating that Buffett came out on the 3rd of May and said that, well, you know, there could be things that would happen in the U.S. that would make us want to own a lot of other currencies. Wow. So this is the guy sitting on the largest cash pile in U.S. history ever by a private firm, Berkshire Hathaway, on what, $0.33 trillion in cash. Then he's retiring. And so on his way out the door, he's like, you know, there's some things that would make us want to own a lot of other currencies. What's he talking about here, do you think?
That's very interesting to me, because one thing that you know about Warren Buffett is he understands history. He's very calculated. He pays attention to where he wants to be 5, 7, 10 years from now, not necessarily where he, you know, where other people mm-hmm. would like to brag about in 3 months. I would anticipate that code speak that, yes, if our government doesn't deal with our fiat currency issues now and get us back to a solid foundation, we're going to end up in a currency crisis and currency collapse, and we're going to have to find the currencies that are doing the right things to stay strong. Because if you know, that takes me back to all I studied in the German hyperinflation. If you're a German citizen, because the U.S. was building a firm foundation in their currency back then, and you transferred your marks out of Germany into the U.S. dollar back then, as the mark collapsed, gold as well as the dollar went up substantially in relation to that currency. So if he's responsible for managing all these funds and being prudent and being in the right place to protect purchasing power, then absolutely he's considered the fact that if we do get into a currency crisis, more than likely a part of your diversification is going to have to be owning other currencies.
You say other currencies, I hear gold. I don't see other currencies that I like so much. The yen? Please. Not a chance. You know, the Mexican peso? No, not big enough, not well managed enough. The Canadian loonie? No. The euro? Mm-mm. So what's left? We talking yuan, Nigerian currency, rubles? At his scale, there aren't that many places to go.
No. And where the existing fiat currency system is around the world, essentially they're all linked to the dollar, right? So the Chinese yuan, everybody's paying attention. Is China going to change the link? Are they going to strengthen the yuan? Are they going to depreciate the yuan? It's all a game against the dollar. So if all of these are going down in their link, if the dollar is going down, the dollar looks strong relative, maybe that's what we've seen gold do on the other side. But what if, Chris, and we've talked about this a little bit, you hear these little bits of news about the unit, we get enough information in the white papers that they say, hey, we're thinking about a 40% backing of gold to the potential unit if the BRICS put this together. Oh, and by the way, there may be some natural resources that are linked to that based on the economy. If you have that as an alternative, right, to diversify from gold into currencies that have some backing, whether they're gold and natural resources, which are the most important reason we need those natural resources for the rebuilding of the economy, houses going forward, the basic of our infrastructure, then that would be an alternative to a fiat currency. And I would expect that's where capital would flow to.
Well,
we don't see that yet, though, outside of precious metals and gold.
No, but Bessent is out there giving us clues. Buffett's giving us clues. Lutnick, I think they're all saying the same thing. Is look, kids, big changes on the way. And we're going to have to do some things that maybe nobody ever talked about before, really seriously considered, including this. This just popped out on May 6th again, which is Bessent coming out and saying U.S. debt trajectory is unsustainable, right? And it's hard to know when the market would rebel against U.S. debt. But, you know, this is stuff like Powell came out and said this in 2023, 24, 25, same thing. Obviously, it's third grade math. You know, the U.S. has an unsustainable debt trajectory. Debt's growing much faster than income. It's a problem. It's a math problem. So, but for Bessent to come out and say that is very different from all of us kind of knowing it.
Yes.
You know, really is. So
they finally spoke about the elephant in the room, and maybe they're having to lay the foundation to let people out there understand, those that are choosing to be blind, to understand, hey, we're going to plant some seeds. If you take this seriously and you pay attention and do some research, now you're going to be better prepared for what we're going to have to do, and you can be better in the fiduciary responsibility of managing the funds of the clients that you're responsible for managing, instead of just whistling Dixie and a baseball bat's coming in your direction.
Whistling Dixie and a baseball bat's coming at your head?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, oblivion is great. You know, being oblivious is great until you get hit in the mouth with a baseball bat. So that's the analogy that I'm trying to paint. So the fact that they're warning leads me to believe that they see what they're going to have to do, and some hard decisions may need to be made. I mean, that's one of the things that they've communicated to us, is the short-term pain will be worth the long-term gain. And we wouldn't have this kind of short-term pain if we'd have had stronger men and women that were laying the foundation and running our government before, and a populace that was a little more discerning in what was actually taking place, instead of being caught up in the prosperity gospel and the competition of, hey, I'm going to accumulate more than you do, without understanding that the government, that this inflation that we're seeing today has been embedded in the system behind, and they've all benefited from it in the asset class, but it's wiped out, you know, the capital class, those who have assets, versus our future generations. I mean, I went this last weekend looking for a home for my daughter in an area recently. They're looking to buy into a new area, and I was heartbroken by how little house your dollars will buy. And, you know, so something has to change, and hopefully they're going to rip that Band-Aid off now before it becomes catastrophic later.
Well, I'm a little disappointed to see the Fed trying to silently begin printing again.
Because I am too.
Listen, I understand why they do it. They have important rationalizations for why they think it's necessary. But can I be clear? all printing does is rescue the stock market and make rich people richer. It's all that happens. Because when they put $35 billion in the market, it's not like they threw it into a field and we all got to, like, Oklahoma land rush for it equally. They give it to Wall Street. Here you go, guys and gals. You get it first. And then, of course, they get first dibs on it, and they get to do stuff with it. So by the time it trickles all the way down to the diner, you know, dishwasher, there's not a lot left of it. You know, it's been inflated away, and there's not much benefit to it. So the Cantillon effect is whoever has access to that wealth first when it's printed and thrown into the market, they secure the most advantage to that. And so that's the system. The Fed prints it. They give it to Wall Street. Wall Street does what it wants to it. And eventually the gardeners get it, you know, way later. So I don't like that the Fed's doing that, because it looks like it's rescuing something. But Paul, if you follow along carefully, which I know you do, every single time they go through one of their printing sprees, the cut line for where people's economic noses are no longer above the waterline just keeps moving higher and higher.
Yes, it does.
First, you had to earn $30,000 a year, and then $50,000, and then $70,000, and then $100,000, and you're officially below poverty line at $108,000 in San Francisco, but it's probably actually honestly higher than that, you know, really. Meaning your income can meet your basic living expenses.
Yes. Yes.
That and would be sort of the poverty line.
That's why, 75% of the population now is living paycheck to paycheck. I mean, essentially, the government has set up a system with their argument of trickle-down economics, which works theoretically in a certain environment. There is some truth to that, but it's not the holy grail of the economic environment. We've seen that, because this trickle down has not worked. It's eviscerated the middle class and the lower, but it's like being at the gym on a treadmill. You go through that pain of getting your stride. You catch your second wind. You're like, okay, I can handle this. I'm doing good. And then all of a sudden it gets faster and faster and faster, and you're having to run harder and harder and harder. And your margin for error becomes less and less, because instead of stumbling and being able to recover yourself from a poor investment here or trying to start a business, that stumbling because the treadmill is running so fast becomes a catastrophic collapse that wipes you out. And it ferments this environment where you have to become speculators to maintain your standard of living instead of being able to make pure investments. And then you've got the Pelosi's of the world and the capital that are connected closest to the printing presses, to the Fed and the politician, Fed and politicians, that have an unfair advantage, right? The closer you are to the money centers, the better you're able to play the game, because the rules of the game are not fair for the majority. They're set up to benefit the minority. And they think they're geniuses and should tell us how to do everything, because they've been closest to the printing presses, really.
They all think they hit triples, right? And they're born on third base, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what concerns me about our political system now. It takes so much money to be able to compete. I mean, it just takes so much money to win a political office, to where it's not your average individual that's able to get in there. And for some reason, they don't believe that a single mom who's never had the advantages that they have can have any wisdom to offer this country, when in reality, they're much better managers of their household than what these individuals are with the millions that they have coming in. It's the arrogance that leads to the destruction of the empire. And we've seen it time and time again throughout history with fiat currencies. And we all want to believe it's not going to happen to us. That's always for somebody else. The history tells us that only the prudent can come out the other side of that with maybe a broken arm instead of a decapitation where their life is over.
So I just want to shift now to this idea that that there's some oil trouble on the way. And I've been, for everybody listening to this, I've been talking about this at Peak Prosperity for my subscribers there for quite some time. But this news really caught me, which was that the CEO of Diamondback Energy, one of the largest shale operators in the United States, said, quote, flat out, that U.S. shale output has peaked. Prices are still plummeting. Forget the prices right now. But the idea that U.S. shale output has peaked is seismic. And it implies that the United States is not going to be able to get more out. I had a great long interview with Adam Rosenschwag of Gehring and Rosenschwag. They talked about their depletion paradox. There's a whole model for this. For anybody who wants to really understand it or geek out like I do, But it's really important, because if you understand energy, you understand where your economy is going to go. It's that simple. And if we're at peak, nobody in the Trump administration or the United States generally, Paul, my hypothesis, they're just not ready for this moment. We haven't talked about it. We haven't prepped. Our SPR is still drained. We haven't put in the energy infrastructure. We're not quite there. And so what was interesting was, this is from that Bloomberg article, in green is their words, white are my words. I put this in a fat pipe, Paul, which is a thing I put up, Peak Prosperity, where I just sort of synthesize what's happening in the world for folks. But he said here that the CEO of Diamondback Energy says production has likely peaked and it's going to decline in the months ahead. And by decline, that's like a forever thing. I mean, it'll wiggle, but that's it. There's a peak and then it's just sort of like a bumpy road down forever. That's it. Oops. He believes that it's a tipping point for U.S. oil production. You don't say, right? And then, quote, today, geologic headwinds outweigh the tailwinds provided by improvements in technology and operational efficiency. Geologic headwinds. It's a matter of geology now, Paul. Nobody is ready for this. We're Saudi America, drill, baby, drill. We're just going to get more to come out of the ground. But as you and I have pointed out before, the blue is what the U.S. Energy Information Agency thinks is going to happen in the future, but green is reality. The reality is, even with this tiny little bump in February, bringing us to 13.159 million barrels per day, that's the same as a couple years ago at this point. So that's what a top looks like. It's all bumpy there. The actual technical top currently, the all-time record, was just back here, tiny bit. It's one of those 2 months back there. But if that's it, nobody's ready for this, Paul. It has an incredible investment thesis behind it. And I'm now seeing for the first time, I just heard on Vince Lancey this morning, that all the big brokerage houses, the big ones, JP City, et cetera, Goldman, are now saying that they think mining shares, not just PM mining, but other mining, is like a once in a 40-year sort of an opportunity. That commodity thesis we've been talking about.
Yes.
That's what this is to me. That's what this is, just screaming. All the stuff you and I have been talking about is now on the front page for those with ears to hear, eyes to see. This is big news.
That's huge news. You're the first person I thought of when I saw that headline from Diamondback Energy.
I hope so.
I did. I was like, lucky there. You know, you're so good at seeing things unfold before they happen. And that's early, but that gives you time to warn people about what's taking place and let them change their perceptions and be in a position to look for opportunities so that they can get out that exit or maximize and protect their family. So that's a huge deal. And the fact that that's starting to creep out, you've got a major, you know, Diamondback CEO, that's a major player that's saying, hey, this is what we're going to have to be dealing with, and this is important. That's a big deal. And I was sitting on the tractor when I was tilling our garden and laying it off, and I got to thinking about everything that you've taught and listened to, and just thinking about, what does my life look like if it's costing me $20 a gallon to run this tractor? Just how much is that going to be ripple through the economy and our food service and our industrial manufacturing and farming? You know, not everybody's doing it like Polyface Farms. So, and how important that's going to be for us to be able to, those of us who can, to be able to grow our own food, not from the health benefits without all the pesticides and the glyphosate, but also having it closer to home so that you don't have all that transportation cost. I mean, just think about the transportation and the trucks that are on the road and the cost. I know you've thought about that. I'm just saying this for the benefit of the listener out there. That's a game changer, but it's also going to be a game changer for those who are adaptive and not in a modern portfolio theory, to where when this kicks off, and I believe we're right at the edge of it, nobody can know the timing exactly. All we know is the fundamentals. Once it becomes common knowledge, that's when those investors who are prepared and adaptive can really protect themselves versus those that are you know, passively just following whatever their leaders tell them to do at some back office in St. Louis that doesn't have to see them face to face in the grocery store, talk to them through Zoom. You know, it's, you know, no relationship with them. The customer's just a number.
There'll always be winners and losers in any particular transition. And so if this is right, if we're about to transition into a commodity thesis, so this is I've always said, Paul, the Federal Reserve is always going to do what it does until something forces it not to, right? Because otherwise there's no forcing function. Why not? Just print money. Nobody seems to care. My friends get rich. I retire. And everybody loves me, right? It's a fun job. But sometimes things come along and you can't do that. So what could cause that, right? So it could be that there's a rebellion. The dollar's no longer wanted internationally. China's decided that they have some brick, you know, the unit could be a competitor to the dollar. They might decide, forget all that. We just want gold. Whatever. If the Fed can't print and just the world has to accept our dollars, because that is that's been the system for a long time.
Uh-huh.
We print money, we loan it to Ecuador, and we don't actually want it paid back. You know, that's not how you maintain your control. You want them owing you the whole time. Keep that, roll that loan as long as you want, guys. But if that ends, if the world says we don't want your dollars, what else you got? It's game over. That's one way it could end. But another way it could end for me is that the Federal Reserve could say, oh, it's getting uncomfortable. Oil's going up in price. We don't like the effect of that. So what we're going to do is we're going to print money, buy bonds, drive the price of money down, and see if that helps, right? And it'll help for a little bit, but ultimately it's going to backfire spectacularly, because now you're going to have more money in the system and less of the actual stuff, the juice that makes you have more stuff in the system. So again, the claims are not real, but they pretend like they're real. That's going to be the dynamic I see setting up. So when people ask me, how could this unravel quickly? I'm like, very easily, because you have a Fed who doesn't understand energy, thinking that the way you combat rising energy prices is by printing more money. And it'll work for a little while, and then it'll fail spectacularly, because you're actually, they're going to have to do more and more and more and more while there's less and less and less and less on the other end. That's the dynamic I see coming. I think it's coming faster than most people expect.
I do as well. And this reminds me of an analogy. People in the healthcare community you can butcher me all you want, but I've never forgotten this. So my grandmother, this was 15, 20 years ago, was on her deathbed, 87, lived a long life. My older sister was the first grandchild, and they had a great relationship because my father got divorced and my grandmother was very important to her. So she was having to drive down from North Carolina. And the doctor said, look, she's probably going to pass away within the next 24 hours. And the family said, hey, is there anything you can do so that Lynn can get down here to see her before she passes? So they gave her a cocktail of mixes, and they said, look, her vitals are going to look really, really good, but she's going to go down quickly after they wear off. And it bought enough time for Lynn to come in. And I think a lot of, you know, that's what I'm concerned about with a lot of these actions that the government will take and the Fed will take. Is like, hey, this may look really good here in the short run, but it speeds up the decimation of the economy on the other side once that initial, you know, injection wears off. And I'm concerned that we're there. And Tavi Costa put together, I know, horrible analogy, but something that was impactful from what I can see economically coming out of where we are. And we don't know where we are here. But Chris, here's another tech weighting versus natural resources weight in the S&P 500. And right now, everybody's chasing NVIDIA, okay? They're still chasing it, the technology stocks, the AI bubble. So this chart goes back to 1990, and look at the tech bubble that occurred back in 1998, 1999, 2000. Mm-hmm. That's all everybody was talking about, is how the internet was going to change the game. And yes, it did. I mean, our economy is completely different than what it was back in 1999, 2000. I mean, Amazon had a whole lot of excitement, but it didn't really come to fruition until, you know, 20 teens. But look where commodities were at that bottom. And we had this slight little blip in the 2008. And have we bottomed here? I don't know. Is this the end of this? Maybe this lasts a little bit longer. But what is going to happen to energy and those stocks? And how are those investors going to be rewarded when that rebalancing in the S&P 500 becomes to where energy is overweighted instead of technology? Because those are the things that we have to have, and the realization and the math that you've been putting out there to everyone comes to fruition, and we get into this situation because of wishful thinking. I mean, this is a major opportunity from my standpoint, and our tools are telling us, hey, you know, you've got to pay attention to commodities. You don't necessarily need to go head over heels into them right now, but they have to be on your radar. You have to have some exposure to them. And as we get more information, increase that exposure if that's what your strategy tells you to do. I'm not making a recommendation to others. We have tools that tell us to do that.
Yeah.
But for the first time in quite some time, the same signals that they were giving us in 2003, 2002, 2003, we're getting again now at this point. And the question is another 2 years, or are we already kind of in that 2003 time frame to where we're going to see commodities outperform over the next 5 to 7 to 12 years?
Yeah. Well, if you look at that, looking at that chart, I may not be doing the math right in my head, but where those where commodities basically went from a 7% weight to about 21%, that's a triple.
Uh-huh.
And the red line went from about 35% back down to about, call it 17%. That's a 50% decline. Uh-huh. So one of these things went up by 200% in percentage terms. One of them went down by 50% in percentage terms. So that's a massive rotation. They're talking from 1999 through till, what's that, about 2008, nine there.
Yes, 2008. And prices actually continued to climb into 2012 for most commodities. But one thing I like to point out was, you know, Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway was down approximately 19% in 1999 when the S&P was up approximately 20. Why was that? You know, I remember this bright personality on CNBC coming out and saying that Buffett was too old and he didn't understand the new economy in this period of time. And instead of coming out like I would and saying price earnings ratios and valuations, blah, 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 Buffett just in his grandfatherly way says, I don't invest into what I don't understand. And then when the market corrected 47% from 2000 to 2003, Berkshire Hathaway was up around 38%. And your value strategies did really, really well because there's a tremendous amount of value in a lot of these companies. They're lean, they're mean, they're underpriced. They've got good business models because they haven't had the capital flow to them like all of these AI companies have that are irresponsible and foolish with their spending. So, you know, I think hindsight, and this is just a thesis based on fundamentals and the data that you're showing out there that you've been talking about for quite some time, we're going to look back in the future and say that in these commodity spaces may have been one of the single best investing opportunity we've had in our lifetime, but it's going to take patience. Okay. Bull markets start slowly. And they shake out a lot of people to begin with. They don't get easy. And I thought about this with a conversation I was having with a client here recently, a couple of clients over the week. When these bull markets start, you get the hope, you know, for the individuals that are exposed to the sector, but they don't get easy until they're in the most dangerous phase. It gets easy in that last year or two because you feel like a genius and there's instant gratification. The best investments don't give you instant gratification. You have to have that discipline and patience to participate in those. Now, good strategies can help you play the game a little bit better. They give you confidence that you're in the right direction and that the fundamentals and the money flow and the technicals line up. And I think that's where we are in the commodity space right now, that those who are looking at where things are going to be and the mathematics that are there and these historical rebalances that take place, if they're patient, they're going to be well rewarded in the years ahead.
The markets are a ticking time bomb. Volatility is spiking, trade wars have broken out, and most investors are sleepwalking into disaster. Many portfolio strategies perform poorly during times like these. At Peak Financial Investing, however, we don't gamble with your future. Our registered investment advisory connects you with battle-tested wealth managers who reject outdated models and embrace active management, strategies proven to navigate chaos, and who aren't afraid to discuss things like the great taking or maybe the importance of protecting your wealth with gold. Without the right approach and with the wrong advisor, you're risking, well, everything. Don't wait for the crash to act. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com right now to schedule a free consultation and discuss your particular situation. Take control of your wealth before the markets take it from you. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com, and I'm Dr. Chris Martinson urging you to act now. I know it's not directly comparable, but, you know, I've been kicking and screaming for years that we need a nuclear renaissance in this country. We just got to go nuke real fast for electricity. I know oil and electricity are not entirely fungible, all of that, but energy is energy. And if you have cheap energy, particularly electricity, you can do a lot with it. I found this interesting that, you know, a couple weeks back, you know, Chris Wright, new energy secretary, saying that the U.S. wants to launch a nuclear renaissance. And so we're talking about it. We're getting there. Let's see. What are they saying here? Yeah. Preparing to deploy money Congress previously authorized to boost domestic uranium production as part of its efforts to kickstart a nuclear energy renaissance. So they're kind of begging and borrowing. Take a little money from here to kick it over to there. Fine. But while we're talking about it, Paul, let's see what we got here. We knew that maybe there's going to be a nuclear renaissance, we hope, right? But while we're talking, China's doing. Look what they did. We talked about this a while ago. They did what's called a hot refueling. So it's running. Their reactor is running. Their thorium reactor, not uranium, thorium. This is just unbelievably the technology of the future, as far as I'm concerned, because we have so much thorium kicking around. But anyway, while it's running, they refueled it. Wow. And then now just here on May 7th, Wednesday here, they've unveiled the world's first meltdown-proof thorium reactor, which is kind of one of their features. But this is really cool, right? So they're talking about they added fresh fuel to an operating thorium reactor, not operational. It was operating. And it's a 2 megawatt, not a lot. It's an experimental reactor. But it's in the Gobi Desert. You know why they put it there? To show that it didn't need water, because all the other nuclear plants are near a river, a lake, an ocean. And they make a lot of waste hot water, and so it kind of messes up river ecology. So they put it in the desert on purpose. Say, look, no water. Look, Ma, no hands, right? You know? And at any rate, but what happens is if this thing does melt down, so to call, it just drains into a pool and that's it. So I think this is astonishing. We're talking about it. China's doing it. If we're not careful, we're going to end up buying this technology. It's be more tariffs and trade imbalances. But we need people trained in material science, nuclear technologies, grid level, you know, you name it. We need people badly in those roles. So I kind of hope that part of this whole make America great again and tariffs is maybe the stick. But the carrot is we need people, Paul, going into engineering right away.
Mm-hmm. We do. Can I highlight one extra part of that article that I thought was very apropos?
You want me to pull it up?
Well, I'll pull it up here, and so I'll highlight it because you covered that first part there. So he goes through here, and without reading the whole article, more significantly, China has relied heavily on long-abandoned American research in the field. In the 1960s, American scientists built and tested molten salt reactors, but Washington eventually shelved the program in favor of uranium-based technology. This is not a compliment to us, but
no.
I like anybody that pays attention to wisdom. So I don't know how to pronounce that. Zhu Hongji? Okay, y'all forgive me. I grew up in North Georgia Mountains. The U.S. left its research publicly available, waiting for the right successor. We were that successor, the project chief scientist Zhu Hongji said. Sorry, guys, if I butchered that. Rabbits sometimes make mistakes or grow lazy. That's when the tortoise seizes its chance, he added. That to me, just tells us that we missed the opportunity. And that's again, investors that are out there, one of the reasons why we run a risk managed and adaptive strategy is there are opportunities that the rabbits miss. And if you're the tortoise from a long-term standpoint, when you get your chance and you're in the right place and you're prudent and you're paying attention to the details and you're patient and you're disciplined, then you can become the rabbit. The next challenge is making sure you don't make the mistakes the rabbit did. So unfortunately, the U.S. missed this opportunity. China picked it up and ran with it. And now they have a technology that if I was Trump, I would be negotiating something in these trade deals to say, hey, can we get access to some of that so we can implement this over here? Will he do that? I don't know. But that's a big deal if you take away the meltdown capabilities and fears, because now you don't have to worry about another Three Mile Island or a Chernobyl.
Totally different technology. I would have one of these in my yard. I really would. And as long as I got a little taste. I don't need much. Fraction of a penny per kilowatt hour, you know. Yeah. Very generous. They're very safe. It's a totally new thing, but the future is going to belong to those who have access to energy, cheap energy, reliable energy. We just saw that big blackout in Spain, which they're being a little tight-lipped about, but the word on the street is that was caused because They had some sort of a surge in the system. The system goes down. And then they had to try and cold restart, but without like baseload nuclear and coal or gas. And they had all this solar and wind. Totally inappropriate for the job. So they were down nationally for, 13 hours is a national blackout. So I think we're learning, okay, solar wind has a role, not the center role, right? This is not, this actress is not ready to take the lead role. Comes in, says two lines, walks off the stage. That's the, right for now, that's it until we get better storage technology. But nuclear's got to be it. And the second thing I want to introduce into this, Paul, because we talk about this a lot, I do believe that the future belongs to those who are going to leverage AI. Well, AI is an electricity pig. It's a very hungry beast. So, again, if you think AI is important, just from a strategy security standpoint, you should be making sure that your grid is as robust as possible, or you're going to be doing something awkward in the future, which is saying, I'm sorry, Cincinnati, you're going to have to go through a blackout for a period of time because we don't have enough for both the city and the data center out there. Right? And but this, again, we just need adults in the room. I don't want anybody with any diversity training making these decisions. I want like a scrappy grid level engineer. You know those engineering guys, Paul? You've met them. They are just that's who I want. I want gray haired, grizzled old grid scale engineers figuring out what we need to do.
Yes. The ones that never have their shirts tucked in and they're calculating math all the time. They love it. They're gifted at it. And that's what they commit their life to. That's what we need. We need the best individual with the best gifts in each category. They don't need to be picked just because they meet some quota. That doesn't serve the future of humanity in the best manner. We need to free people up. Go find what you're good at. Work hard at it and earn your way in there instead of, you know, Here's a check. That's like trust fund babies. Here's a check. Go do what you want to do, right? I mean, if you've got the right trust fund baby and they commit to excellence, they can take those resources and magnify it, right? But just write a check and here's a vehicle and go have fun. That doesn't serve the best for that individual.
Indeed. So, that's all I've got for today, Paul. Any final words here?
No, nothing major. The one thing that I'll plant this seed towards the end. And there are all kinds of chart crimes, okay? There are just a lot of chart crimes. And historical overlays they don't predict the future. They're just something for you to ponder. So there's a lot of optimism after, you know, deglobalization is taking place. Trump's talking about long-term, you know, short-term pain for long-term gain. The environment's completely different now, with the exception of the new information that you provided here, stealth quantitative easing potentially taking place. Hopefully, it's just something temporary. I will say this, the Fed did nothing today. I was actually relieved. Now, I'm going to be a Sparta like to point out the hypocrisy. You had a market collapse in August of last year with the yen carry trade potentially unwinding, and then the Fed cuts 50 basis points coming into the election. And then you have a market kind of collapse here in April after Liberation Day and the Fed does nothing. What's the difference? You know, Democratic versus orange man, bad Trump. I don't know. Seems to be a little hypocrisy, but I am glad that they haven't slammed rates to zero and juiced. Inflation's still strong. House prices are still too much. They haven't corrected. The market's frozen, but we need house prices to come down. We need some deflation to come into the system for the benefit of the majority. Yeah, that's going to be at the expense of those that are blindly, passively just trusting the Fed's going to bail them out. So I'm not upset over the fact that the Fed did nothing today. I'm actually glad that they didn't. But I also want to point out, we're at that point in the system where the chart, maybe I'm not supposed to show the chart crime. Nah, it's working now, so I will show it. So Great Martis puts out, and I thought this was interesting. He says, the Dow Jones 2008 process overlay update. This is something he put out a little bit later. But the pink line is let's see, the pink line would be the Dow now, and the black line is 2008, where we had the big sell-off into February in 2008 with a little bit of rally, retested in June. Market didn't peak until July. There was a tremendous amount of optimism coming into that period of time. Mm-hmm. And then you had the fall-off into the fall. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I also want to point out that just because the market has consolidated and started to heal, just remember, we're at the end of a Fed-fueled, Fed-bailed-out, and taking on huge amounts of debt at the expense of future generations to try to keep these markets up in the interim period and keep these recessions from occurring. I'm hoping that the Trump administration is going to allow some of this excess to be wrung out of the economy. So be patient. Pay attention to where you are. If you don't have 12 months worth of an emergency fund, I'm an advocate of 24 months out there right now. If you have foolish debt and your equities have rallied some, you've had a warning. This is your warning. It's not missing a little bit of return that wipes you out in retirement. It's a 50% decline. So get yourself resilient. Take the opportunity to use this rally if it's appropriate. You got to talk to your financial advisor. I can't tell people what to do, but I can encourage you to consider, put yourself in a resilient situation. Put yourself in a situation where you can withstand a 12 to 24 month period of time without being forced to sell something if we do end up in a recession and if it's not different this time. Maybe the Trump administration navigates this perfectly. It's highly unlikely they're going to navigate it perfectly. So utilize this to lower your risk. If the most recent market decline scared the fool out of you, lower that risk a little bit and get yourself a little bit more resilient. I do not believe that right now is a time to speculate. This is a time to invest, to pay very close attention to the details, and be cautious. Because we've had a warning, there's been technical damage done at a minimum at some point between now and the end of the year. I would expect that we retest those April lows. One thing that's also interesting is these rip-your-face-off rallies tend to occur during bear markets. So the fact that we've had this great rally doesn't mean that everything's all okay. It just means that that speculative fervor has returned here in the short run. Maybe it's Fed fuel, right? Maybe we'd had peak negative tariff news. But we still won't know the damage to the economy until we get summer and into the fall. And I think things have changed. So just make yourself resilient. Get your emergency fund in order. Get rid of any foolish debt that you have. If you're already living paycheck to paycheck, if you can sell some toys, do it while you can choose your price. Because if a recession comes and asset prices do go back to normal valuations, we're 30% below where we are here. So don't be forced to sell in a situation where you have to choose to sell when you can and when those birth pains subside a little bit. So that's the only advice that I can pass to people out there. Just take this opportunity to get yourself resilient and build a foundation that you can withstand trouble if it comes.
Excellent closing words. So for anybody who wants to talk to Paul and or his amazing team, please go to peakfinancialinvesting.com. And fill out a simple form. Somebody from Paul's team will get back to you within 48 business hours, start the process, and it's completely free, no obligation, and very valuable. People are getting a lot out of it, and I know a lot of people end up working with you, Paul, because it's just so good, and the few who don't, I think, still say it's a very valuable process to go through, because, well, it's right over your head. Invest your plan, not your emotions. You're really good at giving people a plan, and I think everybody needs a plan right now. In these days,
it's an honor, and it's always an honor when it's appropriate for us to work with someone, but it's just as much of an honor when it's not appropriate for me to work with someone, but I've handed them a plan that makes them more resilient going forward. And who knows, maybe 4 or 5 years from now, when they're in a position and it's appropriate for us to work together, they'll come back to us because we've been able to take them through something that helps build their resiliency. So our objective is if we can grant somebody some wisdom that makes them more resilient, everything else will take care of itself. Do the right things, everything else will take care of itself. That's our mission. So no pressure. We're not high pressure people. Matter of fact, that's probably my weakness. I'm not the type of person that beats your door down. Hopefully if we work together, it's because you see the value and understand why we do what we do and see that that might can help you be more resilient going forward. And if not, that's okay. Either way, if I can make your life better from the time that we spend together and grant you some more wisdom to walk a path that's more resilient, more prudently, then I've done what I can do before the Lord in this life.
Well, Paul, have a great weekend, and we'll be back next week.
Thank you, Chris. You as well. Enjoy that skid steer.
Oh, I will. All right. Bye for now. See you, everyone.